Well, we're all working together to create something. We don't really know what. And I was reflecting, first morning and many people doing jobs not familiar to them and various little mix-ups and corrections and catches and people taking care of things. A little bit of talking. And I thought, you know, that's really great. It's really great because I think that shows us that we have a healthy community. If things were like perfectly well-oiled and smooth, absolutely silent from the get-go, no, never a mistake, everyone perfectly poised, beautifully meditating, in perfect unison, it would be beautiful, but it wouldn't really be human. So here we have a human experiment with people who don't know what they're doing and are confused or anxious. There's been some heavy waves of anxiety in the kitchen, but we've got through them, I think. You know, this is our human life, and so I was feeling so happy about that. I mean, after this we can settle down a little bit, that's fine, but but I realized, you know, that's a really good sign, you know, that there's a little bit of struggle, a little bit of confusion, a little bit of adjusting and dancing together. As we figure out, you know, how can we sort of create this sort of, sometimes they call this like a perfect, kind of a perfect society for a weekend, you know. And I don't know if it's perfect, but it's got to be, it's a pretty skillful system. It must be. Because how else could 25 or 30 people, like, sort of like live in one room, you know? Cook out of a kitchen that's designed for like somebody who just goes out all the time. And sleep, you know, so many people slept here. I hope the people who slept here last night had a wonderful night, practicing together all night, your dreams mingling. And so this weekend we consider the Buddha. Jeff said last night these are the high holy days of Zen. That's a funny expression. Just like somehow the Christians decided that Christ was born on December 25th, the Japanese Buddhists decided that Buddha was enlightened on December 8th, the morning of December 8th. And just because of other scheduling realities, it's not even going to be December 8th when we celebrate Buddha's awakening, when we do a special ceremony on Sunday morning to celebrate and reenact, actually, to reenact Buddha's awakening. It'll be December 4th. But December 4th actually turns out to be Suzuki Roshi's death day, the day that Suzuki Roshi died 40 years ago on Sunday, December 4th, 1971. So sort of the Dharma grandfather of this center, Shunri Suzuki, and they collected his talks into the famous book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And then more recently there was another book of edited talks, but you know, from the same era, called Not Always So. So I brought that, so here he is. Somebody the other day came to one of our sits and said, wow, have you heard of this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind? I read it was really helpful, and I realized I need to remember to mention these books, you know. Like, oh, yeah, sorry. So about celebrating Buddha's awakening brings up right away some questions, right? What is Buddha? First off, what is awakening? So how can we celebrate this thing, Buddha's awakening? We're not really sure what Buddha is. We're not really sure what awakening is. Are we sure what anything is? And at first blush, it sounds like Buddha is some other person besides us, far away and a distant time. And awakening sounds like some kind of a state, some kind of mental state or something. Or maybe there's like visions and you're permanently happy. And so it seems like if there's somebody else who had or has a special state Why do we want to celebrate that exactly? It's like, well, that's nice. Good for him, you know. But we're still here, in this body, right? In this mind, with all these problems and confusions. So, you know, how is this helpful to us? Well, maybe it's helpful to us because we can notice that we have that silly way of thinking about it. And take a fresh look. And maybe at first taking a fresh look at the idea that we have a state. Do we have a state? What is our usual state? And if the Buddha was awakened, are we asleep? So let's just pause a minute here right now and consider, what is our current state? What do you feel right now in the body? What are the different sensations that are evident in the physical body? And what's happening in the body? Can you feel the breath flowing in and out? Can you feel the heartbeat or the circulation? You know, are muscles twitching in some way? And so is that us? Are we the body? What about emotions? Check in right now. What's the emotional sort of state or emotional tone or something? Or is it even something you can put a word on? Maybe just something you sort of feel and wonder about. So is that us? Are we our happiness or our anxiety or grumpiness? Or maybe we're our thinking. What's the thinking right now? I lay good money you were recently noticing your thinking more than my words. So what was that thinking? And what is the thinking now? So is that us? Are we trying to improve our body or our emotions or our thinking? And of course, if we were to check again now, it would be different. So as all this is always changing, we start to notice that as we practice meditation. And especially, this is a sort of great container or a great sort of laboratory to notice the constantly changing states and thoughts and emotions, the flow of all this. Or is there even a flow? Or is it just one thing and then it's a different thing? Does one thing lead to another thing? Are you sure? And what is this idea we have of this is me? This is my life. This is what happened yesterday. This is what I'm planning for tomorrow. When I was 10 years old, I was such and so. Was that the same person? So all of it seems a little suspect if we think about it. And then we kind of don't know where to go. And the person giving a talk about it doesn't know what to say. Buddhism seems to be saying that this idea of kind of me isn't exactly right. And yet there is a sense of continuity, isn't there? We remember yesterday. That was probably me. It'll probably be me tomorrow. And it would be nice if that person that I think of as me was a little better, a little more like Buddha, whoever he is or was. That would be nice. There's nothing wrong with being a little kinder or a little wiser. Maybe it helps us to be inspired by a cheap concrete garden statue, which is now a beautiful Buddha thanks to our practice. I was reflecting that the other day. We had a very nice Dharma meeting the other night, and Chris Burkhardt, who's now in California, another priest in our center, told some nice stories about Buddha after awakening, and she asked everyone to think about, well, what does Buddha really mean to you? And we were all kind of gazing at the altar. And when we first had our first Dharma hall in Bellingham in, I don't know, 1993 or something like that, nobody had any money, so we just got the cheapest Buddha we could find, you know, which is this concrete garden Buddha. But little by little, somehow, it has become more beautiful and more radiant and truly an awakened Buddha. So I don't know how that works, but it seems to be the case. And so is the same with us? Is it just a matter of time? The concrete Buddha didn't change, I don't think, but somehow it's different. So are you changing in some way, or are you the same as you always were? So since the morning of our Rohatsu Enlightenment Day ceremony will be Suzuki Roshi's 40th death anniversary, I thought we should ask Suzuki Roshi, what is Buddha? He always has some good answers. Oh no, it's this one. Here's one thing. Here's how he said what Buddha is one time. Buddha is always helping you. But usually, we refuse Buddha's offer. For instance, sometimes you ask for something special. This means you're refusing to accept the treasures you already have. You're like a pig. When I was young, as my family was very poor, my father raised pigs. I guess that's kind of poor man's meat in Japan then. I noticed when I gave the pigs a bucket of food, they would eat it after I went away. As long as I was standing there, they wouldn't eat it because they're expecting me to give them more food. So I had to be very careful. If I moved too quickly, they would kick the bucket over. I think that is what you are doing. Just to cause yourself more problems, you seek for something. But there is no need for you to seek for anything. You have plenty. And you have just enough problems. This is a mysterious thing, you know. The mystery of life. We have just enough problems. Not too many or too few. So that's not what we expected, is it? We would like to have fewer problems, right? Read that again. Pig example is funny, but see if you can kind of connect to it. Buddha is always helping you, but usually we refuse Buddha's offer. For instance, sometimes you ask for something special. This means you're refusing to accept the treasures you already have. So that we can watch in Sesshin, right? We want something special. Are we refusing what we already have? You are like a pig. When I was young, as my father was very poor, he raised many pigs. I noticed when I gave the pigs a bucket of food, they would eat it only after I went away. As long as I was there, they wouldn't eat it, expecting me to give them more food. I had to be very careful. If I moved too quickly, they would kick the bucket over. Not sure why that's a problem, but it was, I guess. But I think that's what you are doing. Just to cause yourself more problems, you seek for something. But there is no need to seek for anything. You have plenty, and you have just enough problems. This is a mysterious thing. The mystery of life. We have just enough problems. Not too many or not too few. Only we don't appreciate our problems very much. So Suzuki Roshi seemed to be sort of turning a lot of things on their head. Turning over this idea that we are somehow incomplete, not quite right, not quite Buddha. We need to get something, we need to gain something. We need Buddha's awakening. And somehow, when he turns it over, it opens to some sense of allowing, doesn't it? Allowing Buddha to help us. To help us just be right in the middle of the life we have. And that our problems are not failings, mistakes. In a way, our problems are not problems, but teachings, you know, gifts from Buddha. And somehow, this all made me think about a wonderful little talk he gave about emptiness, about sort of letters from emptiness. And emptiness is a difficult teaching to understand for us. There's some teaching very central to Mahayana Buddhism and very central to Zen. We chanted something about it this morning, about emptiness. It seems to be saying things are not quite the way we think they are. So here's a little more Suzuki Roshi. We're going to celebrate Suzuki Roshi a little bit today, I guess, as our celebration of Buddha. And by the way, these are very heavily edited lectures, and it's fun now as you can actually look online and see the original transcripts, which are like almost unreadable. Like, I don't know how they kept track of what he was saying. But they recorded them, transcribed them, went back and edited them, and then it's very, very, very beautiful. So that gives us heart too, you know. Well, don't you always feel like you didn't say it quite right? Does anyone ever feel like, I said that perfectly? Wow. How come we never feel that way, right? So why do we think we ever go, anyway. So, this is they call this chapter Letters from Emptiness. Shikantaza, so the way we practice Zazen, Shikantaza, is to practice or actualize emptiness. Although you can have a tentative understanding of it through your thinking, you should understand emptiness through experience. You have an idea of emptiness and an idea of being, and you think that being and emptiness are opposites. But in Buddhism, both of these are ideas of being. The emptiness we mean is not like the idea you may have. You cannot reach a full understanding of emptiness with your thinking mind or with your feeling. That is why we practice Zazen. We have a term, Shosoku, which is about the feeling you have when you receive a letter from home. A certain feeling of receiving a letter from home. Pre-email. Even without an actual picture, you know something about your home, what the people are doing, or which flowers are blooming. That is this feeling of shosoku. Although we have no actual written communication from the world of emptiness, we have some hints or suggestion about what is going on in that world, and that is, you might say, enlightenment. When you see plum blossoms or hear the sound of a small stone hitting bamboo, like famous Zen stories are referenced, that is a letter from the world of emptiness. So to really see or hear something is a letter from the world of emptiness. Beside the world which we can describe, there's another kind of world. All descriptions of reality are limited expressions of the world of emptiness. Yet we attach to the descriptions and think that they are reality. This is a mistake, because what is described is not actual reality. When you think it is reality, your own idea is involved, and there is the idea of self. There's the idea of self. Many Buddhists have made this mistake. That is why they have attached to written scriptures or Buddha's words. They thought his words were the most valuable thing, and that the way was to preserve the teaching and to remember what the Buddha said exactly. But what the Buddha said was just a letter from the world of emptiness, just a suggestion or some help. If someone else reads it, it might not make any sense. This is the nature of Buddha's words. To understand Buddha's words, we cannot rely on our usual thinking mind. If you want to read a letter from Buddha's world, it is necessary to understand Buddha's world. To empty water from a cup does not mean to drink it up. To empty means to have a direct, pure experience without relying on form or color of being. So our experience is empty of our preconceived ideas, our idea of being, our idea of big or small, round or square, big or small, don't belong to reality. They're simply ideas. So there's no empty water. We have no idea of water, even though we see it. When we analyze our experience, we have all kinds of ideas. That's true, isn't it? So many ideas. Ideas of time or space, big or small, heavy or light. A scale of some kind is necessary, and with all our different scales in mind, we experience things. Still, the thing itself has no scale. That is something we add to reality. Because we use a scale and depend on it so much, we think the scale exists. But it doesn't exist. If it did, it would exist with things. Using a scale, you can analyze one thing into entities, big and small, but as soon as we conceptualize something, it is a dead experience. And he goes on to talk about that for quite a while. And then he talks about art and nature. Art and nature. So there's so many ways that we can explore our life. For artists or writers to express their direct experience, they may paint or write. But if their experience is very strong and pure, they may not even try to describe it. Oh my! That's all they can say. I like making a miniature garden around my house. If I go to the stream and see the wonderful rocks and water running, I give up. Oh no, I shall never try to make a rock garden. It's much better to just be at Tassajara Creek, picking up paper and fallen branches. The thing itself is emptiness, but because you add something to it, you spoil the actual reality. So if we don't spoil things, that is to empty things. When you sit in Shikantaza, don't be disturbed by sounds. Don't operate your thinking mind. You could also say don't be disturbed by thoughts. This means don't rely on sense organs or the thinking mind, and just please receive the letter from emptiness. That is Shikantaza. So we're listening. You know, we're listening for letters to emptiness, from emptiness. So maybe somehow that's how we celebrate Buddha's enlightenment, is to forget about Buddha's enlightenment. Forget about everything. Just listen. Just be available. Maybe some letters will arrive in our inbox. You know, be like the AOL thing, right? Beep, you've got mail. So, that was just like the preamble. But actually, the real talk you're supposed to give a Rahatsu is you have to talk about the story of Buddha's awakening. But I thought, it's not too good to think about the story of Buddha's awakening unless we think a little bit about the way we use these stories. Because it's so easy for us to take the story of Buddha's awakening and sort of feed it through our cultural milieu as another sort of heroic quest, which we are not, like, up for, you know. You know, the Buddha was a great hero, and he went on his heroic quest, and he succeeded, you know. You know, that's nice. But how do we use this? Well, we listen for letters instead. But nonetheless, it's important to your education, so we have to say a little about the story of Buddha's awakening. You know, it's my job. I have to do my job. You know. But realize this is empty of any actual content. Or message, or useful stuff. But maybe it'll inspire us to let go of all this stuff. So I've, you know, thought about the story of Buddha's awakening many times, and I've given many talks like this, and after a while they kind of get boring, like, oh, you're saying the same thing over again. And but this last time, when I was again thinking about the story of Buddha's awakening, one part of the story struck me in a fresh way. So maybe that's how these stories are useful. If we read them again and again, think about them again and again, they may strike us in different ways, you know, as our life changes. And so I was struck by this part of the story. It's right after the Buddha leaves his family. He goes off, you know, on his quest. Becomes a kind of a monk. And he finds the great teachers of the day in the area, and it's hard to really know historically exactly what was going on, but it seems to have been a sort of a transitional time in that culture where there are just quite a few spiritual teachers wandering around and, you know, a lot of different sort of religious things happening. So apparently it wasn't that hard to find advanced meditation teachers in your local, you know, back 40. So here's how the story is told in the Pali Canon. So it's nice to kind of hear the style of text. So the Pali Canon is the sort of oldest complete written down version of Buddha's teachings after it was repeated orally for hundreds of years. So who knows, you know, what really happened or what the Buddha really said, but this might be as close as we're going to get. So this is the Buddha speaking. While I was still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the first stages of my life, and while my parents, unwilling, were crying with tears streaming down their faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having thus gone forth in search of what might be skillful, seeking the unexcelled state of sublime peace, state, it's right there, I went to Alara Kalama. So there's a meditation teacher named Alara Kalama. On arrival, I said to him, "Friend Kalama, I want to practice in this doctrine and discipline." When this was said, Alara Kalama replied to me, "You may stay here, my friend. This doctrine is such that a wise person can enter and dwell in his own teacher's knowledge, having realized it himself through direct knowledge." That probably sounded good. Good. Direct experience. That's what I want. It was not long before I quickly learned this doctrine. And as far as mere lip reciting and repetition, I could speak the words of knowledge, the words of the elders, and I could affirm that I knew and saw, I along with others. And I thought, it isn't through mere conviction alone that Alara Kalama declares, "I have entered and dwelled in the Dhamma, having realized this myself through direct knowledge." Certainly it's true. He dwells, knowing and seeing this Dharma. And so I went to my teacher and said, "To what extent do you declare that you have entered and dwell in this Dharma?" When this was said, he declared the dimension of nothingness, so emptiness. And I thought, not only does Alara Kalama have conviction, persistence, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment, I too now have conviction, persistence, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment. What if I were to endeavor to realize for myself the fullness of the Dharma that Alara Kalama declares he has entered and dwells in, having realized it himself with his direct knowledge? So it was not long before I entered and dwelled in that Dharma, having realized it through direct knowledge. So he really got it, you know, experientially, after, you know, first memorizing everything. And I went to him and said, "Friend Kalama, is this the extent to which you have entered and dwelled in this Dharma, having realized it for yourself through direct knowledge?" So he presents his understanding, just like in the Dokusan room. "This is what I understand of practice." And Kalama said, "Yes, my friend, that is it." And he said, "This, my friend, is the extent to which I, too, have entered and dwell in this Dharma, having realized it for myself through direct knowledge." So yes, you have it the same way I have it. Wonderful. And Alara Kalama went on to say, "It is a gain for us, friend, a great gain, that we now have a new companion in the holy life, that the Dharma I declare and have entered and dwelled in, having realized it myself through direct knowledge, is the Dharma you declare and have entered and dwelled in, having realized it yourself through direct knowledge. And the Dharma you declare and have entered in and dwelled in, having realized it for yourself through direct knowledge, is the Dharma that I declare." You know, so they were thorough, you know. "And having entered in and dwelled in, having realized myself through direct knowledge, this Dharma is, I know, is the Dharma you know. The Dharma you know is the Dharma I know. As I am, so are you. So you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together." And in this way did Alara Kalama, my first teacher, place me, his pupil, on the same level with himself, and pay me great honor. But the thought occurred to me, this Dharma does not lead to full disenchantment, dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to awakening, nor to unbinding, but only to reappearance in the dimension of nothingness. So, dissatisfied with this Dharma, I left. And so, and then the whole thing repeats again, almost verbatim, with another teacher, so I won't bother you with that. And this is like already this translation, they've removed a lot of the repetition already, you know, so this is like the short version. So when you first read that within through the lens of the heroic quest, you're like, well, yeah, of course, you know, he's the hero, he's not going to accept, you know, second best, you know. But if you try to put yourself a little more in his shoes, let's think about this a little bit. You have some trouble in your heart, you know, you're seeking your sincere heart. as Jeff said so beautifully. And you find a way to somehow address this, and you practice deeply in this, and they don't say how much time went by. Sounds like, you know, a day, but maybe it was a year. And you receive some praise. You receive some validation. You receive, you know, some love and some deep support and an invitation to stay with that, to rest in that. I think we're all a little more influenced, you know, when somebody praises us in that way. So it kind of brings up for me, how do we work with praise and how we work with blame? Somehow the Buddha's pain, you know, that sense of something is not right here, was so strong that it, you know, he could feel that still. He could feel, oh, much as I would like to stay, thank you very much, teacher, but, oh, it's not quite it. The way it's written, it just kind of sounds like, yeah, you know, I'm out of here. Not good enough, but I think we could think about it in a little bit deeper way. And we could put ourselves in his shoes in a kind of literal way. You know, what if you went to practice? What if you finally, like, took the plunge and quit your day job, you know, and went to the monastery, practiced there with a teacher you really respected, and after a while they said, oh, you've really got it. Wonderful, wonderful. You know, would you like to stay and be a teacher? And let's say they also offered you a salary and benefits. Would you stay? Or would you say, oh, not quite sure. Thank you very much, Cook, so we'll record the rest. But what about, but that's a kind of a heroic example. None of us really can quite picture ourselves doing that. But what about the small ways in our life? We do something, and everything we do is in some way in relationship with somebody. Somebody else, in relationship with ourselves in some way. You know, are we seeking some kind of praise in some way? How are we influenced with that? How we work to that? Or do we get blamed? Do we get scorned? Do we get criticized? How is that? So maybe another way to look at the way Buddha practiced in this moment with the teacher and the way we could practice in our sesshin is not so much about doing something or getting something, but just kind of a letting go. Kind of a letting go, like, oh, praise, you know, oh, letting it go. Oh, blame, oh, thank you. Letting it go. And what's wonderful about sesshin practice is we, even though it was a little busy kind of getting organized this morning, there's a way that we simplify our life, right? What we have to do today and tomorrow and Sunday morning is pretty simple. Stand and walk, sit, ring a bell or chop a potato. And so we can notice the one who wants to do it right, the one who wants praise from ourselves or from others, or the one who feels like she can't do it right. We'll never quite get it right. We can notice him and her arising. Maybe Buddha can inspire us. Maybe we can listen for a letter from emptiness in that moment. Ah. And maybe one way we can do that is to lighten up a little bit around the many ways that we try so hard. We do need to make an effort. This traditional container, these practices we've received, are powerfully useful. We have a lot of faith in that. It definitely helps to sit down on the cushion every time. Stand up and walk carefully and mindfully. But how do we do that? What is our spirit? And this is not so easy. We think it sounds easy, but of course we know it isn't. We make many mistakes. We feel a heavy load of blame and shame, and a powerful desire deep in our gut for praise and support and love. There's nothing wrong with that. And we want to be so perfect. We notice the way the mind seems to go, that we can do something very well 99 times, and then one time, oh! And that stays with us, doesn't it? Like, oh, why did I do it that way? Oh! So maybe we can appreciate Buddha sitting there with Alaraka Lama. It's like, oh! What do I do now? And maybe it's not so much about what do I do now. Maybe we just have to be here. It's like our concrete Buddha, just sitting patiently. It's allowing the practice to do us. In that quiet, empty space is where the real celebration of Buddha's enlightenment happens and is already happening and is always happening. So, thank you. Please enjoy not doing too much today and tomorrow.